Welcome back to the History of South Africa podcast with me, your host, Des Latham. This is episode 232, Diamond Geology as an Art, Dinosaur Veldskoene and Waterboer's Claim. Just a quick note about that amazing podcaster, Nicole Engelbrecht. She is the host and creator of True Crime South Africa, as well as the author of numerous books, Samurai Sword Murder, Sizzlers, and the co-author of Killer Stories. Well, there's another book in her growing body of work called Bare Bones, Cold Cases from True Crime South Africa. It's part of the Jonathan Ball stable. I've been given an advanced copy and been reading it, and it's chilling. Perfect to read on a frozen winter's night in front of a fire. Right, on to 1870. By the start of the year, there were about 1,000 diggers near the Vaal River hunting diamonds. At the end of that year, the number had risen tenfold to 10,000. They made their way to the area from around the world after landing in Cape Town or Algoa Bay and some in Durban. They had travelled up to the river diggings, taking 2 months or 6 weeks if they were lucky. Once there, they'd set up camp, pitching their tents, building little shanties or living in their wagons. These global prospectors first headed for the largest of the camps, a place called Klipdrift, which eventually became the town of Barkly West, which is around 35 kilometres northwest of Kimberley. The new El Dorado, as it was being called, saw men dressed in what was called a proper digger's outfit. This consisted of a broad-brimmed hat, a corduroy suit, a stout waist belt with pockets all around, extra strong boots, a bowie knife, a revolver, and of course spare rounds of ammunition. Then they'd have to secure the seat from the ports to the dry uplands, preferably in a bullock wagon or some kind of Cape cart drawn by horses. They were riding shotgun or at the back, along with around 3 tons of goods consigned to the camps because everything had to be transported in. There was virtually no local food available. Even water had to be carted from higher up the Vaal. It took 40 days to trek to the diggings for the quick trip, with many holdups, including a fairly lengthy delay at Bethuli in order to cross the mighty Orange River. The river diggings now stretched about 40 kilometres west and northwest towards Delport's Poort. The rush to gather alluvial diamonds along the rivers had begun along both banks of the Vaal River. The rise and fall of this important waterway had washed thousands of these gems onto the surface in channels, both current and ancient. From 1867 onwards, most of the diamonds were being picked up by local Tswana and Griqua, and the local chiefs controlled the early trade. It appears that diamonds were being brought to the chiefs by their followers as a form of tribute, because it was clear that these little stones were of great value to the white traders and new diggers. The town of Ditkatlong nearby was the great place of Tlaping chief Yanki Mutibi. Before he could monopolize trade in the treasure, a new crop of merchants arrived, one by the name of Herbert Rhodes. He, like all the others, used picks and shovels to carry the sand and soil to sifting screens from where they plucked their glittering prizes. More about Herbert later. Two farms emerged as main locations for diamonds, Bultfontein and Dorsfontein. We've already met Dorsfontein's owner, Meneer van Wyk, in a previous podcast, whose children were adept at picking out the diamonds. Some even found diamonds in his wattle and daub hut walls, glinting in the early morning or late evening light. The source of the mud for the adobe walls was the nearby farm pond named Dutoitspan, and into the pond leapt the diggers, with permission and a license from Van Wyk, of course. It quickly became a major digging site, and the pond was emptied faster than a mug of brandy during a voortrekker braai. Prospectors rushed into what became dry diggings, and mostly they forcibly occupied the land. Chief Mutibi and those Griqua left in the Transoranje became eyewitnesses and sought assistance from the British government. Soon the speculators descended, led by a group of merchants from Port Elizabeth. I don't know if you remember our previous episode where we discussed at length the development of the merchant sector in PE, how well placed these men were to take advantage of the inland gem rush. Cape Town was 1,000 kilometres away, Kimberley to Algoa Bay 700. Furthermore, the Algoa Bay merchants had developed an agent system. They had been trading in wool with suppliers inland. They had set up buyers in the small towns of the Northern Cape and the Southern Free State. They had built credit systems, financial tools, other networks. Now they followed up on their steady growth with a surge in capital and bought the farm of Bultfontein. Then they began the process of evicting the diggers, who they called squatters. But there was no police force, and the company had to give in to the diggers, who in turn agreed to pay a license fee for the right to prospect for diamonds. This was rough and tumble stuff. Business in South Africa is like that, you know. The 1860s had been a difficult decade in the country, laced with regular rumours about imminent discoveries of gemstones and gold. Finally, now, a true story. Hints and allegations. There were real diamonds under the soles of their veldskoens and extra-strong boots. In these early days, the first diggers, black and white, all panned and scratched, searching for the rare stones, foraging assiduously up from the confluence of the Vaal and the Harts at a camp accurately described as Debtor's Hope, then heading northwards through another equally accurately described as Bad Hope, then on to Gong Gong, Fool's Rush, Union Kopi, Delport's Hope, Forlorn Hope, Waldeck's Plant, all the way up to Hebron. Fool's Rush was perhaps a misnomer, because that was near where the city of Kimberley would spring up out of the dry flatland, like an alien spaceship floating on a sea of money. Hopetown, where the first diamond was found, was inside the Cape south of the Vaal River, but now most of the diamond fields were developing north of the Vaal. So who owned that land? Griqualand West captain Nicholas Waterboer believed it was his. The Griquas here were uneasily exposed in a salient of territory, a kind of peninsula on a map, projecting into the Orange Free State across the Vaal River and to the west, abutting the Tswana territories of the Kalahari. He was the eldest son of Andries Waterboer, who had founded the Waterboer dynasty, along with his wife Gertrude Pienaar, and they lived at Griquastad. Waterboer's people had been largely ignored by the Boers earlier. Since the mid-18th century, the Busters and other groups had migrated away from the Dutch and the Cape, as you know, crossing into this territory. At first dominated by groups of bandits, when the Griqua formalized their ownership alongside the missionaries, settlements grew in places like Philippolis and Bethuli and Griquastad. Waterboer's land was regarded as less inviting. His main rivals were not the Boers or the British. They were the Tlapping people who'd lived there before the arrival of the Griqua with their horses and their muskets. During the 1850s, Tlapping chiefs in the northeast came under increased pressure to sell their land to the Boers. A market in land had been created in the sovereignty period, and the commercial boom of the 1850s greatly stimulated the demand, both for speculative purposes and for merino sheep farming. It was during the 1850s the Griqua in the west, under Adam Cook III, began selling their farms, leading eventually to their mass exodus to Griqualand East, beyond the Drakensberg Mountains in 1861. You know about that if you've listened to the series up to now. In this somewhat confused land ownership process, and in a situation in which patronage over large numbers of followers was no longer the main path to, or the sole index of, status and wealth, Tlapping chief Lepoy and his sons saw little reason why they should put the corporate interests of the community above their own. It was plainly more worthwhile to enrich themselves at the expense of commoner households by leasing the springs and surrounding grazing lands to Boers. Lepoy and his sons also gathered Griqua advisors educated in the Cape to ensure they were not ramrodded. Chief Lepoy turned to one in particular, Richard Miles, who was actually a Tswana man with an amazing history, another of our wildly interesting forebears, folks. He was born at Tswana and as a youth ended up working for apothecary John Harfield Treadgold in Cape Town. How he got there, no one knew. He was too young to remember. But it was believed he had been one of the children misplaced by turbulence on the frontier in the 1820s and ended up being dragged into the inbuxling system where youngsters were apprenticed into a virtual life of slavery on farms. Saved from servitude by the Treadgold's philanthropic society, he worked as a school assistant teaching colonial children and took up various roles for the British government in the Free State. He spoke English, Dutch, Setswana and Korana. The Tlapping also deployed Teuns and Rolf Neufeld, Andries Giel, Frans Valentijn, and a man they just called Galant on what became known as Lepoy's Raad, a Volksraad, an innovation borrowed in 1858 from Griqua and Boer society. These men prepared and signed all Lepoy's correspondence because they were literate, he was not. By the early 1860s, the area to the east around Bethuli had been sold off to the Boers. A glance at the map reveals the land lies between the Bosie Spruit and Slick Spruit rivers, which flow almost perfectly due south. The former into the Orange River and the latter into the Caledon River just before it joins the Orange. But westward, close to Philippolis and inside these diamond fields, Nicholas Waterboer continued to exercise control over territory that became extremely important to investors who had high friends in places. Compounding the to-ing and fro-ing was the Free State Boers' anti-English sentiment. They were so angry about the ongoing attempts by the Empire to interfere in the independent state business that they'd kicked out Standard Bank from the Free State in 1865. This hampered prosperity, making it far more difficult for farmers to access cash at times of need. They'd also expelled missionaries, which was a bit of a red flag for liberal humanists in England who were lobbying for the British government to take more control inside South Africa. This contributed to the Free State being in a very weak position when it came to what historian Frank Welsh calls the sudden eruption of an invasion of diggers from 1870 onwards. And by the end of 1871, there were now 50,000 African workers. For a place that was isolated and recorded only a few thousand people scattered across farms, this was a severe social shock. Sit back and imagine the scene. The veld around what would become Kimberley is a mix of savanna and Kalahari thorn veld, typical of that region's open landscape. The area is known for its diverse plant and bird life due to the meeting point of the Kalahari thorn veld, high veld grasslands, and the Karoo vegetation. Characteristic camel thorn trees are abundant, along with various acacia species like Katdoring, Hakensteek, and Trassies Bos. It is part of the Great Karoo, characterized by arid and semi-arid conditions. Into this parched land, beautiful but spiky and a test for the uninitiated, flooded men and some women from first the Cape and Natal, then Britain, Australia, California. Even local Boers dropped everything and joined in the melee, along with the Tlaping, the Rarlong and the Basutu, who threw in their lot, joined too by the Pedi and the Tsonga from the Transvaal and as far away as Mozambique. This first group, like all other South African stories, arrived in a kind of melting pot. Blacks and whites did land deals, exchanged diamonds and goods. It was the effervescent democracy that takes root when entrepreneurs have energy, when the rules are ill-defined, and a group of like-minded people of all ethnicities draw up their own instant laws. It was only later that through a number of political uprisings that race would become more defined in terms of who owned the diamond fields and who was allowed to own them. It was very sudden, this tsunami of people from all walks of life. Young officers who'd lost their commission but were connected. Surgeons who'd had too much competition in the Cape, looking for new opportunities. Those who'd been retrenched during the depression the Cape had suffered through much of the 1860s. Pedi with saved cash. Tswana who collected together and bought claims and so on. Pretty amazing. The diggings were full of aggressive and ambitious young men developing their ideas and seeking their fortunes inside sprawling camps of tents and huts. First Bultfontein, 1869, De Toispan, 1870, De Beers Farm in April 1871, then Vooruitzicht, July 1871. The diamond discoveries sent shockwaves through every corner of South African life, with the sciences feeling the jolt first. Geology and mineralogy suddenly mattered in a way they hadn't before, as men sought to read the land for clues to its hidden riches. But at the root of it all lay something deeply human, an eternal hunger for instant treasure. It's the same impulse that drives a gambler to scratch a card or chase a lottery win, that rush of endorphins when chance seems to offer everything, or when a pan yields a diamond worth thousands. The diggers were indulging in a 19th century tatama chance. These treasure hunters were placing their bets on a terrain that had once scattered its wealth along rivers and streams, even the ones long since dry. The discovery of diamonds gave geology a new significance, one where the focus swung from Europe or the Americas to Africa. Observing the popular craving for knowledge of mineral potential, the acting curator of the South African Museum, Henry Piers, called for more structured government support of geological surveys. He also acknowledged that the museum's extensive mineralogical collection was too cosmopolitan and general. In 1870, Grahamstown Dr. Sir William Gibbon Atherston, who we met in an earlier episode, if you remember, was commissioned by the Cape government to investigate reports of all minerals hidden in the Karoo between the Swartberg and Nieuweveld. If you also recall, Atherston's reputation as an expert was enhanced by the distinction of having verified the first diamond discovered near Hopetown in 1867, thus sparking off South Africa's mineral revolution. A new magazine called The Cape Monthly had been launched and began publishing Atherston's travelogue as he and Andrew Geddes-Bain trekked around South Africa looking for hidden treasure. The editor demanded, in his words, a gossiping article with a golden thread of geology. Their writings are full of ethnic slurs defaming the Khoi, the Boers, and everyone else who was not English. The chattering races of the rocks is how they refer to the San and the Khoi, taking the hyperbolic vitriol to new levels of race-based gossipiness. For all their colonial arrogance, their work with the rocks was surprisingly useful. Atherston, influenced by early evolutionary thinking, began piecing together a new story of the Earth. As he uncovered fossils, now known to be hundreds of millions of years old, he proposed that South Africa lay at the far edge of the ancient world and had actually escaped the biblical flood. These men, standing at the crossroads of plate tectonics, geology, and human history, were wrestling with a deeper heresy that the world might not be 6,000 years old after all. Atherston's coy wagon driver cracked a joke, saying that the footprint-like impressions in the Karoo rock they'd discovered might imply that Adam had actually worn veldskoens. It so happens that there is just such a dinosaur called Massus pondylus, found extensively in the Karoo supergroup, an early Jurassic herbivore that was bipedal, about 4 to 6 meters long. Its footprints measured around 20 to 30 centimeters, which is not far off a large human footprint. The shape of the prints were broad, somewhat rounded, with blunt toes. You could just about imagine them flattening the sandy Karoo mud like a farmer in his veldskoene. This travelogue set off a vigorous debate in the Cape Monthly that human habitation in South Africa may be measured in geological time. Many of these debates and scientific papers were published in the Journal of the Society of Arts in England because geology fell under the arts back in the day. Later, specialist publications for geology and archaeology were launched. The Journal of the Society of the Arts acted as a bridge in mid-Victorian Britain, publishing geology when the discipline was still entangled with practical trade and colonial enterprise. As geology professionalized and specialist publications proliferated, the JSA receded from this space. There was a quickening now of geological investigation into the Northern Cape. Eminent geologist Dr. John Shaw conducted his own study of diamonds around the Northern Cape and noted that many tended to be found near the kopjes, those that dot the landscape near the Vaal River. He further concluded that the rocks there were sedimentary, which is correct, and that the number of salt pans could prove that at one time the area was washed by an ancient sea that eroded rock formations around the kopjes. That was also correct, as we now know. Therefore, he surmised that diamonds were likely to be found in bulk below the initial layers of sedimentation, particularly in riverbeds. But it took a German petrographer called Emil Cohen to finally observe that the yellow diamond-bearing soil was going deeper within the confines of a border of shale rock. A petrographer in 1870 was a field geologist, examining rocks with the naked eye or a hand lens and then classifying them and speculating about origins. These days, a petrographer focuses on describing rocks microscopically by using thin slices that allow light to pass through and then examine minerals and the rock origin. Cohen's theory, which is still the prevailing science, was that diamonds were formed deep within the earth under high pressure and then blasted to the surface in volcanic pipes. Subsequent action of water and sediments spread them around the surface, and that was why the first diamonds of the Cape were discovered by alluvial mining. Naturally, the question for all these scientists arose, so where were the likely main volcanic pipes? Because if these were found, that would be the mother lode. As with all things innovative, another geologist then leapt forward to claim this theory as his, a local man, Edward Dunn. Cohen and Dunn formed up in a pre-social media poison pit and launched attacks on each other through the Cape Monthly magazine. Meanwhile, the diggers scraped away and the investors and bankers lined up. The lawyers and the politicians also began to line up. Free State lawyers at first, Volksraad emissaries, because much of what was going on, what was happening north of the Vaal, meant they naturally assumed this was inside the territory of the Free State. The land, though, also flanked the Zuid-Afrikaanse Republiek, so both sets of Boer republics laid claim to much of the diggings, which was a somewhat flimsy claim, because both sets of Volksraads had commented harshly about that country there, calling it a wasteland, inhabited by savages. They called Hottentots and Kurana half-breeds. Now they backtracked. They restated their views. It was actually good land, and they'd always owned it. The Suid-Afrikaanse Republic announced in 1870 that the territory in which the diamond diggings were situated included their district of Bloemhof. An odd moment took place, which happens when politicians get confused. On the ground, the diggers negotiated ownership with direct owners of land, not some distant government. They couldn't care less if it was Tlaping, Griqua or Boer. Only at Hebron, the northernmost point of the diggings, was the Suid-Afrikaanse Republic's claim honoured. A group of miners, Munich, Posner and Webb, were granted the exclusive rights to search for diamonds in the territory along the Vaal above its confluence with the Harts River, and that by the ZAR Volksraad in July 1870. That implied a monopoly of all diamonds, and the diggers below the Hebron camps made it known there would be an armed uprising if the ZAR attempted to enforce this decision. President Pretorius, not one to allow an ultimatum to go unchallenged, rode to the diggings himself along with a VIP bodyguard of 30 armed Boers. He jumped off his horse and read a proclamation on the spot claiming ownership, following which he ordered the hoisting of the Vier Clear flag of the ZAR. Remember, these camps were full of men who had left everything across the world for a chance at riches. They had nothing and yet everything to lose. One was Captain Roderick Barker, who told Pretorius that if the flag was hoisted, he'd pull it down. Two English-speaking burghers were put in charge of the ZAR claim, a man simply called Evans and another Hugh Gwyn Owen. President Pretorius nominated Evans as chief flag raiser and Hugh Gwyn Owen as local magistrate. Evans tried to hoist the flag, but Captain Barker ripped it from his hands. Pretorius tried to intervene, but this international group of diggers were not easy to dominate. They stood firm. Hearing about the fuss, a large posse and a command of Stafford Parker were on their way to sort out the ZAR interlopers. Stafford Parker was also the newly appointed President of the Diggers' Republic, a motley crew of camps who decided to pool their resources against outsiders, a kind of madcap state of extra-strong boot and corduroy suit wearers armed with bowie knives and revolvers, and heaven only knows what else. The Boers, led by Pretorius, spotted the cloud of dust approaching, leapt onto their saddles and disappeared. Evans appeared to be made of sterner stuff. Jutting out his jaw, refusing to leave, he was promptly thrown into the Vaal River and managed to drag himself to the other side. I'm going to deal with Stafford Parker and the Diggers' Republic next episode. A strange tale, folks, but well worth a listen. Hark, friends, far away from these dusty flats, a young man on a cotton farm in the Natal Midlands was stirring. It was only 2 years earlier that Herbert Rhodes had left London for the greener fields of the newly annexed territory of Natal, arriving in Durban on a small ship from London in April 1868. He bought a 250-acre cotton farm in the Umkomaas Valley near the modern town of Richmond, and in 1870 read about the exploits of the folks on the diamond fields in his local newspaper, the Natal Witness. He didn't wait for his brother, Cecil John Rhodes, who was en route to South Africa from England, to arrive. He packed his corduroy suit, wide-brimmed hat, extra-strong boots, waist belt with pockets, his bowie knife and revolver, and took off for the diamond fields. What happened next is for next episode. Please rate the podcast on your favorite platforms. That helps elevate its visibility. You can head off to desmondlatham.blog, where I'll load an update about these episodes. You can email me from there, and please do register for my little newsletter. Until next, happy digging.